Danielle Raphael is here with me, as she is every morning, for a little bit of book club on your radio. Good morning, Danny.
Hello, Pam.
How are you going this morning?
I'm doing good. It's been a good couple of weeks of reading for me, actually. There have been some absolute rippers.
I love that for you.
I love it too.
It's been a little quiet in the reading zone for me, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
I've been trying to really get through a book that my book club has been tasked with, and I've got about halfway through so far. Danny, I hate to break it to you. I'm still in this, what is it called? The Museum of Modern Lovers.
Oh, Pam.
I'm still in it. I'm trying to listen to the audiobook.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
I hear you, though. It swings and roundabouts. Sometimes I don't want to touch a book, but you pick one up and it just does it for you, that's it.
I know that our next book is going to be Heartburn by Nora Ephron, and Meryl Streep reads the audiobook for this one. So, look, that's going to be an audiobooker for me just for the fact that Meryl Streep is reading it, but I do have the physical copy at home. It's kind of that wonderful intersection between a classic story, a rom-com. It's looking at divorce, but also Nora Ephron writes some of the best movie scripts of all time and has written some of the most relatable and some of my favourite stories. So I don't think that one's going to be one that I'm going to struggle to get through, but I am looking forward to it. What have you been reading recently?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you had me at Meryl Streep, and that book is on my to-read list as an audiobook because of Meryl Streep. I think it'll just be beautiful.
Oh, it'll be beautiful.
But I've been, I'm getting stuck into Carolyn Hughes' new book, The Alternatives, which is set in Scotland. It's about four sisters who kind of reunite over a tragedy, and I've only just started, but I was hooked last night kind of reading into the late hours. It's really good. So, watch this space. It'll probably be on book club in a couple of weeks.
Maybe it will be. Let's get across some headlines. Now, these headlines, there's a hilariousness about the headlines that we're getting into.
You gotta
this
laugh
morning.
Or you'll cry, Pam.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I was gonna say. Talk to me about what's going on in Utah.
Yeah, well, Utah has outlawed books by Judy Blume and Sarah J. Maas in the first statewide ban. So we've all heard of, quite nauseating book banning situations in the US recently, but this marks the first time that a whole state has outlawed a specific list of books. And it's because of a law whereby if a book is banned in three districts or two school districts, it therefore, according to the state, warrants a whole statewide ban. And this specific banning has come about because of a bill called House Bill 29, which has amended the way that people evaluate what is considered pornographic material or indecent material. It's quite upsetting to hear of these book banning situations, and they have been quite prevalent in the States in recent years, but it's not new to Australia either. Just last year, there was a council that banned Yumi Stein's book, Welcome to Sex, which just caused like an absolute maelstrom of moral panic because of the assumed content, or perhaps, people thinking that the book wasn't appropriate for a certain age group. But the thing about these, the interesting thing, I guess, and the funny thing about book banning is that it's, often in conservative countries or groups or districts, and the people that are banning the book statistically often haven't read them either. So it's kind of pointing to, I guess, this demonization of minority groups, specifically LGBTQIA+ community, queer community. And it's upsetting, but I guess if you are kind of riled up about these things, as we saw in the situation last year in Australia in the council of, I think it was Yaz, I believe, there was really strong community support behind the reinstatement of these books. And people do have power. And if you do get behind your local library and, if a petition comes through your social media feed or on your email inbox, then signing that does make a really big difference to having these books back on shelves.
It's a really interesting headline. And the first thing I did when you told me about this headline was I Googled what the state of abortion laws were in Utah, and I didn't really think about how much those two were linked for me, but censorship and then the sort of will to govern women's bodies, they go hand in hand for me when you think mm-hmm. about, you know, really conservative US states. Yeah. Of course, I found that abortion is outlawed in Utah. Surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. And they had this thing called a trigger law. So they had set it up that when Roe v. Wade happened and it became, you know, federal law to be able to access an abortion in the US, this state in particular came up with this trigger law that if it was ever overturned, it would immediately become unavailable in this state. So in 2022, when that overturning happened of Roe v. Wade, this law just came back into place and abortion was outlawed again. And it's really interesting that across this list of books, we've also got authors like Margaret Atwood and Rupi Kaur.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we didn't actually mention the books that are banned, but Judy Blume.
Yes. Like, what are you doing banning Judy Blume? Yeah. Like, she's not hurting anybody.
She's not hurting anybody.
Let her be.
Yeah. Sarah J. Maas, who wrote the Court of Throne and Roses series, which I personally haven't read, but I know it's been quite successful commercially, that has also been banned. Basically the whole series, like if you look at the list, it's all of Sarah's books are in there. Margaret Atwood as well. And, you know, no one's saying that that content isn't disturbing, but should it be banned and censored?
Yeah.
Yeah, in my opinion, I don't think so.
Absolutely not. It's a lot of women, a lot of authors that are women. It's a lot of women that are authors writing about women's experience, women having autonomy over their bodies, whether that be in a direct or sort of indirect capacity. Rupi Kaur is a poet who is not my favourite, but does have a really, really huge identity and association with advocating for the rights of women and for the autonomy and ownership over your own body. Margaret Atwood historically writes about women's ownership over their own
the
bodies.
The irony of Margaret Atwood being in that list.
Margaret Atwood being in a banned book list is,
doesn't
you know,
go, yeah,
that's
doesn't
a if you don't laugh, you cry
absolutely.
Moment for sure. So these are some really interesting, it's some really interesting news, and I think what you had to say about the power that we do have in overturning things like this, going to your local library and advocating for the books that you want to be available. Even if you're not a library attendee, people, imagine not having access to the books that made you who you were as a child. If I didn't have access to the books that introduced me to queer lit for the first time, or, you know, the autonomy that women can have in fiction, which then you can apply to your real life, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. So books are significant.
Absolutely.
We're mentioning a sort of a queer icon and a queer lit thing, and that seems to be what's going on with the book today. I don't know much about our blind date with a book, but tell me about my blind date. What's going on
I'm
with
so
the book
I'm so excited
this
about this date. Benjamin Law has also been on a date with this book, and he has said that this book is an instant queer classic.
Oh,
so
I
take what
that.
You will from that. I definitely trust his opinion. But today's blind date is about the first love of a teenage girl and how powerful that is, particularly when the object of that desire is her best friend,
also a girl. Been there.
What happens next hinges on a big decision. To live an openly queer life or to try desperately not to. Pam, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I really want to read this. This is immediately going on the bedside table. This is an experience that I relate to, and I want to read about experiences that I relate to. Queer classics are hard to come by because there's a lot of them out there, but there's a lot of queer fiction out there now, and it's really exciting that it's out there. But those classic tales that aren't, for me, aren't skewed by a presence of sci-fi or a presence of some strange robotic creature. And I love the inclusion and the intersection of those stories. But for me, I want a queer classic.
Yeah.
I just want a classic love story with a queer tilt to it.
Yeah.
I really need it.
For a queer story to just exist as it is a beautiful thing. And I think Dylan Hardcastle, the author of Language of Limbs, has absolutely done that. I've written some notes, and my notes are for this book, made me weep in capitals, because it did, and that's a very hard thing
Jenny.
For me to do. It was so beautifully realised.
You don't cry a lot when you read, right?
No. Or in movies, historically, even as a child.
You're not a weeper?
I'm not a weeper.
Wow, I'm really a weeper. Sometimes I just weep because I feel like a weep, you know?
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes sometimes it's really impressive to hear that a non-weeper has weeped at a book.
Well, yeah, I think if I'm the benchmark, then...
Wept.
I knew what you meant. We know what you mean. But the story is told through the eyes of two characters characters known as Limb 1 and Limb 2. They don't have names. And in these alternating chapters, we kind of go along with them as they grapple with their identity and sexuality by forging very, very different paths. One taking a conventional path and the other kind of really exploring their sexuality in the height of the kind of queer community in the 80s in Sydney.
Oh, great.
So that we begin in the 70s from the perspective of Lim 1, and she's caught by her mother being intimate with Lim 2, who is her best friend, and she's essentially kicked out of the family home. And she hitchhikes to Sydney, and there she finds her found family in a place called Uranian House, where it's just basically a whole bunch of queer folk who have come to live there as a refuge. And in chapter two, we meet Lim 2, and she's kind of grappling with what has just happened and, you know, sets off on her way without her best friend, going to uni, meeting a very nice boy, getting married, buying a house, trying to have a child. So it's, these alternating paths that are very, very different. But the beauty of this book for me, I think, is how the paths do often cross. But almost cross, I should say. They never quite meet. So there's always these like real kind of tense parallel encounters that are never quite realised. Uh-huh. The fun part about this book is especially in the chapters of Lim 1, where she does move to Sydney and she is kind of just thrown into this wonderful queer community in the 80s, where they are witness to the first ever Mardi Gras, where they are involved in student protests and they experience the devastating impact of the AIDS epidemic. So it's rendered really beautifully and considered within the context of the queer community in the 80s. And there has been some criticism that it's, you know, it's quite like on the nose. It's too on the nose. But I think Dylan Hardcastle has really just explored the really dark themes so sensitively and with so much compassion, and really conveys the joy of finding your identity and the LGBTQIA+ community during that time and how that legacy has then informed the present day community.
I think it's interesting to think about that, right? That it is sometimes queer stories get the label of being overdone, obvious, or kind of picked over in terms of the thematic presence, right? But when you're setting something in the 80s and you're trying to explore a coming of age that is set in that time, it's based on different priorities, different experiences, and a different understanding of what it was to be queer in a public capacity. So it kind of needs you to have that more direct, more out approach, more upfront sort of discussion and unpacking. It can't be this, although beautiful, really as nuanced and sort of subtle unpacking that we have the absolute delight and sort of privilege of being able to have with a lot of queer stories that are set in the present day. We're able to be slighter about it. And you can still be slighter about it when it's set in the 80s, but it does feel like there's a necessity and an urgency to unpack things that feel a little more, I'm not sure about this story, but that feel a little more present, that feel a little more pressing.
It absolutely feels true to me, and I'm not part of that community, so I highly recommend listening to Dylan Hardcastle speak with Michael Williams on the Read This podcast. And Dylan goes into this idea of how during that time, spaces like, the Uranian House that I did mention, these, you know, a fictional space, but also real life spaces like dance floors during that time were really sacred because they were a matter of life and death. And I think Dylan does a really great job of recognising that history and paying homage and tribute to the people that have paved the way for the contemporary community. So, a really good listen if you want to understand a little bit more about the time and the mechanics of the story. That podcast is great, but all in all, I love this book. I've been recommending it to everyone. It's beautiful, touching, fun and funny as well, in all the right places, punctuated with so much joy and humour. So A Language of Limbs by Dylan Hardcastle, a very big 5 out of 5 stars for me, I think, ma'am.
Oh, gorgeous. This is definitely a successful blind date. I'll be finding this book and taking it on a second date, I think.
Amazing.
Thanks for Book Club this week, Danny.
Oh, anytime, Pam.